So we're hanging out at Troost Lake at 27th and Paseo. On a typical spring or summer day, you will find a pretty good crowd here taking advantage of a patch of nature in the heart of the city. People like Ahmad Myers and Ricardo Heron come here a lot for fishing.
Yeah, this is my spot right here. This is a hot spot right here.
We've pretty much been getting bites since we've been here all day.
It's a scene that probably would have made George Kessler a happy man. He was the guy behind the design of this lake, Paseo Boulevard, and, well, all the boulevards in Kansas City. And he was really into the idea that nature could be revealed in the city. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to explore the history of what some people consider, not everyone, but some people, Kansas City's first boulevard, Paseo. We'll learn how it's changed and find out what's in store for the future of this winding, picturesque roadway on Kansas City's east side. Daniel Serta is with us from Insight Planning. He's a regular on our design and infrastructure conversations, hashtag if you build it, KC. Hi, Daniel.
Good morning.
Paseo has a really rich history and a very specific aesthetic that ties into the entire boulevard system and how it was conceived. We're going to get into all of that history in a lot of depth later on, but for now, just super quickly, what are the main points people need to know? Paseo Boulevard basics.
Sure. Well, I think the most important thing to know is that, Paseo was originally conceived of back in the 1890s when the system was first being designed. It was one of the first two north-south boulevards or parkways conceived of in the city.
What was the other one?
The other one is what became Benton Boulevard. And there is a design distinction between boulevards and parkways in Kansas City. Boulevards have frontage but no median. Parkways have a median, a landscape median, like Ward Parkway, for example. The boulevards, it's less apparent in some of them for reasons I'll get into later, but they were typically designed with three rows of what were called columnar street trees, or very tall vertical trees in three columns along the edges, very deep setbacks, true also of the boulevards. But again, the boulevards are distinguished by the broad medians like you find on the Paseo.
So anything else you think we absolutely need to understand about this boulevard, Paseo Boulevard, before we start talking about what's going on there now?
Sure. Well, two things are the way that Paseo fit the template of what Kessler was trying to achieve in Kansas City. He was really trying to do two things simultaneously. The first, as you alluded to, was reintroduce nature into what was becoming a very congested city, and to do that by specifically trying to allow nature, as really the topography of the city had revealed itself, but it then sort of been run roughshod over by real estate development, to reveal that natural landscape again by preserving the scenic vistas of the gullies and the ravines that many people found not scenic in Kansas City. But Kessler had a way of, from a landscape design perspective, of making those very attractive features of what he hoped would become a very distinguished world city.
Well, let's bring Mark McHenry in on this. He's the director of Kansas City's Parks Department. Mark, anything you want to add on Paseo background, Paseo basics?
I will tag on to Daniel's comment about a world city. All this was happening in what they called the City Beautiful Movement. Going back 120, 130 years ago, Kansas City was a town growing along the Missouri River. And the vision of the leadership in this city, as we indicated, George Kessler, along with August Meyer and William Rockhill Nelson, brought forth the development of the City Beautiful Movement. And that's when our park system started. Actually, we're sitting here at 125 years, the beginning of the Park and Boulevard system, which goes back, of course, to 1892. The first plan that was done in 1893. And it envisioned, there again, Paseo was a big part of that. Also Independence, Benton, as mentioned earlier by Daniel. And that's kind of how the whole system got started at that location right there at Independence and Paseo.
So you guys, what are some of your favorite spots on Paseo? I like that freestanding traffic light that's got a roundabout around it. It's so random and weirdly beautiful.
That is a very good point. And, the interesting thing about that is it's very unique. And the other thing is it survived all these years, too. Mm-hmm. It works. I mean, it's still part of the traffic system.
Did there used to be others like that? Or has it always been this lone, freestanding traffic light roundabout?
There may have been others. I'm not aware of those. You know, that's, of course, prior to the days we had mast arms, which reach across the boulevard. So we actually like to see something of this nature. So it's an icon. It's also a survey point, too. Interesting enough, if you do a surveying in Jackson County, this is kind of the benchmark point. So all of Jackson County surveying either goes east, west, or north, south from that location. So it actually is a pivot point for surveying purposes.
Weird.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the northern end of the Paseo, in part because the pergola, for example.
Are you talking about there?
This is, Mark, correct me, I'm going to get the intersection wrong. I'm going to say 10th Street. Is that right, or is it 10th?
It's 11th, yeah.
It's at 11th Street. Mm. But there's a pergola in the median along the Paseo. And one of the things I really love about it is the fact that it is a tangible vestige of the original design. Not just Paseo, but many of the parkways and boulevards in Kansas City, they've been altered for a variety of reasons over time, not the least sense of which is the development that's along those parkways and boulevards. But this is a place where literally you can go and you can see an element of the original design that dates back to that very early period.
I love driving on Paseo because it winds around in this sort of glorious way and takes you up and down hills, and you catch all these different views of the skyline and neighborhoods, and it seems totally unaware of the grid surrounding it.
Well, that's the interesting thing about Paseo. It's a very deliberate reintroduction of that natural topography into the grid. That's one of the peculiar things about Kansas City. There are a lot of things written in the early history of the city that say, you know, you couldn't really have picked a more foreboding location for a city.
Why?
Because, for example, the landing that we think about, you know, Westport Landing and the riverfront, there was an escarpment. You know, there's this massive cliff at the base of the river. It wasn't a logical place to disembark. There were cuts through through the hillsides that created new ravines that were required to that. And then we spent the better part of, you know, the first three or four decades of the city's existence, sticking this, you know, rectilinear north, south, east, west grid, this cardinal grid on a topography that was anything but. And again, that was a large part of Kessler's design emphasis, was to try to reintroduce that natural topography, those slopes, the ravines, some of the natural features, the areas where water wanted to gather anyway, turning them into landscape features like lakes, like Truce Lake, for example. And it is really an object lesson in how Kessler went about doing this in a way that still served a lot of functional purposes within the city.
So right now, there are some major changes coming to Paseo, the most significant probably being the Paseo Gateway Project. That's where a couple of old motels, Motel Capri and Royale.
Yeah, right.
They've been torn down at Paseo and Independence Avenue, where Paseo meets I-35 just south of the Bond Bridge. You've got the historic Northeast just to the east of that spot and the City Market and Columbus Park to the west. What is going on there, Mark?
Well, just as you described, Gina, it's the Paseo Gateway Project. The reason it's called a gateway is because you come off the Bond Bridge and you're coming, of course, from North Kansas City, and then you enter Kansas City at that point. So it's the gateway to Kansas City.
And would the idea be, too, that someone coming off the highway traveling perhaps from further than just north of the river would also be entering the city at that point?
That's exactly right. And so we want it to be a great location as a gateway. And so there's a couple, three things happening. It's a traffic intersection that's a little dicey right now as far as traffic flow east, west, and north, south. So we're planning now to improve the intersection.
What is dicey about it?
Traffic circulation, accident prone, things of that nature. People not quite exactly sure what lane to be in at the right time as far as turning movements. Left-hand turns, right-hand turns, things of that nature. So traffic flow is part of that. Also an enhancement. It was looking a little shabby. Part of that was contributed by the two motels. A lot of activity happened in those motels. It's probably not something that everybody wants to talk about every day because of some of the, there again, negative activity. The Capri was torn down about a year ago. That was the one that was on the east side. And then very recently, the Royale, which is the one on the west side, was torn down. So it opens up the intersection as a view corridor. It allows for the traffic intersection to take place and then do some additional enhancements and landscaping and create a great gateway feature as you enter into the city.
I want to hear more about those in a moment, but sticking with those motels for a second, you're right, they did not have a great reputation, and that's putting it mildly as far as the kind of stuff that went on there. They were known for high-profile crimes, issues with prostitution, all kinds of things, but they were iconic visually in their own way, don't you think?
I think they were, and if you go back in time when those two were built and you're thinking about what other...
And when was that?
I don't know the exact day, but it's probably back in the 40s. If you think in those time frames, how many motels there was in Kansas City? If you're coming to Kansas City, as you say, from the north and maybe beyond North Kansas City up into, you know, into Iowa or wherever, you know, this is probably where people stayed. And then over time, probably a lot of change in ownership. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, drugs and prostitution started to move into the area. And so they became much less desirable and obviously not the place people would go to stay. And that's kind of what's happened over a period of time. So that was the reason they needed to be removed in order to do that. And so people are finding places to stay in other locations in the city.
Daniel, just chime in for a second, if you don't mind, about do you think that there is aesthetically something that those motels meant to that spot and anything worth acknowledging about that?
Well, I find some irony historically in the motels becoming problematic because one of the things that factored into the designation of the route for Paseo and some of the other boulevards and parkways were what planners back in that period and still today would refer to as blighting influences. Back in that period, there was much more concern about the quality of construction and sort of a disharmony of land uses. In other words, there being a lot of mixture of land uses along certain streets, more than, say, vice and crime per se, although those were also issues. They were also very heavily concerned with health issues like overcrowding and housing and that sort of thing. So one of the side benefits, so to speak, that was very deliberate in the planning of the parkways and boulevards in Kansas City was that they were effectively used as an early form of blight abatement and slum clearance. So there were areas of substandard housing, for example, particularly in the parks that were created, West Terrace and especially as well as North Terrace Park, which is now known as Kessler Park. Those areas had a lot of very substandard housing, and that housing was cleared out to not only provide scenic vistas but to remediate the ill effects of that. And here we are, you know, as Mark says, 125 years later, sort of going through another round of rebeautification and
we're remediating our remediation.
Exactly. I made the point all the time that, you know, everything was glorious and wonderful when it was new, right? And there was certainly a lot of forethought and a lot of investment in the original design of those buildings. I think the reality is if you look at the history, despite changes in ownership, despite very deliberate efforts to remediate what was happening from the standpoint of, you know, keeping those buildings there, maybe changing ownership, maybe
they
changing
They looked kind of like mid-century Vegas.
Yeah, they were. They very much were. But again, those problems were never fully resolved.
One thing I might add, and I'm glad you mentioned that from an architectural perspective, the Capri, as I mentioned, the one that was on the east side, had a very iconic neon sign.
With always at least one letter out.
Yes.
And, as far as the lights went.
We our Parks and Recreation Department here in the city now oversees the Kansas City Museum. So we collect artifacts throughout the city that contribute to our inventory of Kansas City's history. We have the sign off of the Capri.
Oh, cool.
And we salvaged it, and we have it in storage. And the reason we did that, because it was iconic. And there again, a vestige of Kansas City architecture from the past.
So help paint a picture for me of what this intersection that will become less of, it sounds to me like you want to make it into less of an ordinary city intersection and more into something that kind of welcomes people to Kansas City in a more deliberate way.
Well, yes. And the one thing that we are also doing on this is working with the Kansas City University of Biosciences, which, of course, has their campus right there on the northeast corner. And they're doing some great things. They have a new campus master plan. They're adding facilities. They're expanding their footprint a little bit to accommodate their students and their faculty and some of their new buildings that go in. So part of it will be better access to that facility. And then as we indicate this gateway, and kind of hard to describe a design here over the radio, but I will just use the example of a roundabout. We're not going to build a roundabout, but if you can visualize a roundabout, which are very iconic in their nature, where you have a good flow of traffic coming through that, that's the way we've kind of envisioned this thing, because you've got traffic off the bridge. You've also got this access to the universities at that location. And then the other thing is we have to look at it from the standpoint potentially streetcars would come through here at Tumsheim in the future as we expand our streetcar system. There's been conversation about moving that down along Independence. So we designed for allowing a future streetcar, and that's a couple of things that weigh into that.
When I think of a roundabout, I think that part of what a roundabout does, other than take people in a circle, is it opens up an intersection. Mm. Is there going to be some physical opening up?
Yes, that's exactly right. And then when we talk about a gateway, you visualize some kind of a vertical element yet to be designed, where it would be somewhat iconic and something that's elevated, and lighting is part of that, landscaping is part of that. So it's that welcome to Kansas City view that we're trying to accomplish in that design.
How might this whole thing change the nature of the Paseo itself, the aesthetic, the driving experience, and just like what's emphasized on the street? Because it's got kind of a mellow personality right now, if you know what I mean.
Well, and I think in the design of what we're doing, we're trying to pick a little bit of the vestige of the past because of the history. And as we go further south, and as the mentioned by Daniel, the pergola, we want to keep some of that architecture, but also more welcoming as far as the future. I might mention a couple other things beyond the pergola. There's a fountain located at 9th and the Paseo. That was our first fountain. That goes back to the turn of the century, and it's very
Kansas City's first fountain?
Yes, 9th and Paseo.
That seems like a big deal.
Yes, big deal. For the city of fountains, it's a real big deal. As you know, we have 48 fountains in the city right now, or throughout the entire metropolitan system. And that one was in disrepair, and it was restored. And so it looks like it does when it was built over 100 years ago. And then there's also a sunken garden down at 12th Street. There's a large colonnade structure located at 12th Street. All of those are there today. So you have some of the major infrastructure from Paseo at Independence on down to Truman that's really been restored and back to its original glory at the turn of the century.
I'm going to ask you later to tell me more about the sunken garden, because I've driven over there and I'm not sure if I know what is sunken about the gardens, but we're gonna get to that later, because we've just heard what's going on at the northern end of Paseo, and I'm curious about the southern edge of the boulevard. And remind us how far south it goes.
79th Street.
So there's a project going on in that area, the Marlborough Control Project?
Yes, this is the Upper Blue River Basin Project. It's stormwater management and control. It is a project that is being led by the Water Services Department. And there again, it's to prevent flooding and better water management. And so they're utilizing part of the Paseo, since it has a large median, which is a lot of green space, and that's where the water can go. And then you have native plantings within the median that helps manage the stormwater. And so the Paseo is coming into use not only as the beautification and the traffic flow, but also for stormwater management.
So this is a question for both you, Mark, and you as well, Daniel. I mean, do you think that change happening along Paseo right now reflects something bigger going on in Kansas City, something we should be talking about? Or is this all very particular to the ways of the street?
Well, I think there's a couple of things in answering your question, Gina. One is that there are larger infrastructure investment efforts going on throughout the city. And in the example that Mark mentioned, the Marlborough Green, Target Green Project and the work that's going on down there, there you're seeing the very local impact of those citywide efforts playing out in a particular way around the boulevard. So I think that's important. Going back historically, I think in what Mark is describing in a contemporary sense, it's important to always note that there are really two fundamental features about the boulevards and the parkways. One is the roadway itself and how the roadway is designed and configured. And then the other has to do with the pattern of development along the roadway. And that's what's shifting throughout the city. You have residential development going on throughout the city. You have new commercial development going on. You also have continuing historic rehabilitation going on. For example, you know, near 18th and Vine along the Paseo, you have the new Buck O'Neill History Center and the old YMCA building. There are any number of efforts that are happening and playing out, a lot of different dynamics of really kind of a return to the city and reinvestment in the city that happening, that are playing out in particular ways along the boulevards,
So I think it's important to highlight that we're not just talking about how features of a boulevard are changing, that we're also talking about changes in people's lives and what people do and how people use this boulevard and live along it.
Absolutely. You know, there's a big return to the city movement, so to speak, that's been going on for the better part of a decade. And we hear a lot about downtown proper in the Central Business District, but that's playing out in Midtown and other places. And there are a lot of conversations around the ways that development along the boulevards, the walkability of the boulevards, the scenic features of the boulevards contribute to that sort of anchor that's attracting people back into the city.
When KCUR Central Standard returns, the historical significance of Paseo and the whole story of that aesthetic. Plus, how'd it get that name? I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman talking about Paseo Boulevard, or the Paseo as it's popularly known, with the director of the Parks Department, Mark McHenry, and urban design expert Daniel Serta. Hey again, guys.
Hey.
Hello.
So, later in the show, we're going to be taking questions about spots on Paseo that have piqued your curiosity and observations about what it's like to live, work, and travel this changing historic boulevard. For now, let's get more on that history, because when we talk about what's changing, we might be really missing that this is a historically significant roadway. First of all, why is Paseo called Paseo? That name stands out.
It's named after a major boulevard called Paseo de la Reforma in Mexico City. And one of the things I would say about that, you know, I'm not entirely certain of all the reasons for the allusion to Mexico City of all places, but I can tell you that what the Paseo did in Kansas City is not different in orders of magnitude from what, you know, a major boulevard in a world city like Mexico City accomplished, or what, you know, the Champs-Élysées, for example, in Paris accomplished. Thinking back to 1892, 1893, Mark reflected, you know, there was 20 years of advocacy that built up to the formal introduction of both the Parks and Boulevard system in Kansas City, and specifically the creation of the Board of Parks and Recreation Commissioners. That was a long, very messy political fight.
What was messy about it?
Well, there was a lot of opposition from business groups specifically, because what that really required was a couple of things. The city had to acquire power to be able to condemn private property. And so there was a lot of controversy about that, very early introduction of eminent domain.
Yeah, still controversy about
exactly.
that.
Exactly. And there was a fair debate back then, in the same way you hear debates today about sort of the proper role of both the national and city governments, you know, should the city get involved in this sort of thing? There was a fair question back then about whether it was really a proper role for a city to take on to be developing parks and managing parks. I mean, that probably sounds odd to us, but that was not a resolved question at all in the late 19th century. Cities had very limited powers back in that period. And I could tell you one of the powers they absolutely lacked was any kind of regulation of land use, any authority to do that. That didn't happen for 25 years after the introduction.
Why? What
of the
were
system.
People worried about with cities having a role in land use?
It wasn't so much that there was worry about it. It's simply the powers of cities were very, very limited. They really dealt fundamentally with just sort of policing the streets, keeping the cities orderly, you know, maintaining a sense of order and decorum in the city. And the private sector, by and large, you know, sort of managed itself. And there was a lot of reluctance to have cities take on additional powers, in part because one of the things that would mean is that they would require more resources, which meant higher taxes and that sort of thing. So there were all kinds of debates about the merits of establishing a park system. But once that was accomplished, it became a fundamental mechanism for changing and directing. And that was really part of Kessler's design philosophy, was that this was going to become a lasting legacy, an institutional framework as much as a physical framework for directing and providing a vision for how the city was going to grow really for the rest of its existence.
And wasn't there some controversy about commerce along boulevards?
Yeah. So, you know, among the political compromises, so to speak, in doing this, you know, we don't think about it as literally now, in part because there have been some changes over the last 125 years. But if you look at the original boulevards that were established, they were by definition residential arteries only. The boulevards were largely kept out of the business districts. Again, that was a sort of a political compromise to avoid some of that tension with real estate developers and commercial business owners and others. And the emphasis and the benefits that were seen for boulevards were largely argued and articulated as being about creating not only more stately, but healthier and more attractive residential districts throughout the city.
I am kind of confused about this a little, because why couldn't something be attractive and have commerce?
It's not that it couldn't. It's just that one of the mechanisms proposed for funding the boulevards and parkways was what's called a frontage assessment, which still exists today. Essentially, there's a tax levied, a property tax levied, if you own property that fronts on a parkway or boulevard. And again, that political compromise avoided imposing those assessments as additional property taxes on commercial businesses.
Well, the one thing I might add, too, institutional facilities along the boulevard and parkways are pretty well known. Churches, as an example, synagogues, schools, things of that nature. So beyond residential, there's several of those kinds of facilities up and down the boulevard and parkway system. The other thing the park and boulevard system did was link parks. So if you were to, for today, for example, if you were in Swolt Park and you wanted to go to Parade Park at 18th and Paseo, you could drive a boulevard or a parkway all the way from the start to finish.
That's true, and I've never thought about that before.
So there's that long linkage. The other thing that probably worth noting, too, is when you look at the Paseo back to its mainly focus on residential and institutional in nature, you have two major streets, Troost to the west and the Prospect to the east, that are both very commercial in nature. So as you go from the northern part of the city down south, you can drive any one of those three, Paseo being primarily the open spaces and the residential, and then Troost and Prospect more commercial in nature.
So that's interesting, because it's also fairly new information to me that this is part of why we call some things boulevards and some things streets or avenues, is that boulevards are not built for business.
Well, not in Kansas City. It's often the case in other cities. And that's something that's kind of peculiar to Kansas City in terms of the nomenclature. But the parkways, I mean, one way to think about it is that literally the parkways are routes that connect. It's the way to get from one park to another. I mean, the basic design, the basic framework of the original parks and boulevard system in Kansas City was a network of district, you might call parks, West Terrace and North Terrace, I mentioned before, as well as Penn Valley Park on what was then the south end of the city. The city limits at the time were at 27th Street, which is hard to conceive of today, that, you know, anything beyond that was essentially cornfields. But those larger parks were connected by the parkways. They were the ways that connected one park to another. And I think it's wonderful. We've kind of lost this. And I remember talking to Mark about this, gosh, probably 20, 25 years ago. There are guides that were published in the 1920s when automobiles became very prominent that were an entire day's journey traveling the scenic byways of Kansas City. It was essentially a guided route. They were these little pamphlets published that typically started at Union Station and would take you on a tour and excursion throughout the entire city along its magnificent boulevards and parkways.
That sounds really fun and also totally environmentally unfriendly.
Well, you got to consider at the time, cars could probably travel all of 15 miles an hour.
Yeah.
So.
So a slow scenic trip through Kansas City.
And it was the boulevards and parkways were very much designed to be enjoyed visually at a leisurely pace. You know, again, in the 1890s, we didn't have automobiles. We had horse-drawn carriages and people walking places.
So how does Paseo stand out within Kansas City's parks and boulevard system?
Well, I think first it's the longest, as we mentioned earlier, just a little less than 10 miles long from start to finish. And also the fact that it does kind of change a little bit characteristically-wise. We talked about the parkways having wide medians And then we talk about the areas that are called boulevards that don't have the median. So in essence, it changes its character mm-hmm. quite a bit. That north piece of it has got more of a parkway feel, but it's more formal, so it has more of that boulevard feel. And then as you come down past the location we mentioned by Truce Lake, much more parkway feel. In this section from Linwood, as you mentioned earlier, Gina, where the traffic signal is, down to 47th Street, is very, very, very formal. No median, very, very formal. And so that changing characteristics gives it that component. The other thing about Paseo, too, is it carried a lot more traffic in the past than it does today because of Bruce Watkins Drive. As people would come from the southern part of the city up into the city, before you had the Bruce Watkins Drive, you would drive the Paseo. So it has less traffic. So we are actually looking now at doing some work on the Paseo. There's a term called road diet, and this allows...
You try to get more bikes, more pedestrians.
You got it. That's exactly what it is. Make it more bike pedestrian friendly and maybe not so car centric. And that process is going now. As you may be aware, the city is redoing its bike plan. And one of the things that is being looked at is the entire Paseo from either, again, road diet, bike plan. So maybe some of
that would be, I mean, when you talk about something built to be enjoyed mm-hmm. at a slightly slower yeah. pace. In my case, it would be a much slower pace than a car, but a bicycle is a perfect way to enjoy a street built for that.
Yes, and if you can imagine, I mean, you know, there again, some of that pavement then can be dedicated for bike lanes and not so much cars, and then a slower pace. So more, you know, bike pedestrian friendly and less car safe. The other thing worth pointing out on the boulevards and parkways, kind of back to your question about commercial, trucks are not allowed on boulevards. So that's why you have streets where the commercial, because trucks have to service these commercial properties, whereas they're prohibited on the boulevards.
But I want to go back to the history of the Paseo a little bit and get into, you know, George Kessler, when he designed the Paseo, was in some ways going against the grain of what other people were wanting in the city, maybe. And he was really fighting. He was really fighting for his vision. And I want to spell that out a little bit more.
Sure. Well, just from a practical standpoint, what constructing the Paseo required was land clearance. I mentioned that before. And if you look at it, typically the width of the Paseo, it really varies north to south. I mean, even from Independence Avenue down to, say, 12th Street or Truman Road, there are variations there where the depth and the frontage is everything between a full city block. So it bows out in some places where it's probably two to three city blocks wide when you get further south, say down toward 27th Street, and then becomes much narrower through the central part, what is now the central part of the city, back then would have been the much further south part of the city. So that process of acquiring land, again, that was controversial. It was a matter of introducing these formal landscape elements. And that's one of the things that's really interesting about Kessler. There were other better known landscape architects, principally Frederick Law Olmsted, who focused on what you might call a very formalistic approach. Kessler used a hybrid approach of both a very naturalistic approach of creating, recreating, and revealing nature as it had been found, as well as introducing some formal elements. You mentioned the sunken gardens before. That's a great example of a very formal landscape element introduced into what is otherwise a very naturalistic approach of design.
What has changed on Paseo since it was originally constructed? We could go on for a long time about this, but it seems like there are a few things to hit on, which are interstate development, sprawl, and public housing.
I would say the most dramatic development, and you see it probably more on Paseo almost than any other boulevard just because of the way it physically expresses itself, is the level of demographic change that's happened in the city. The Paseo crosses through places that not that long ago were very racially segregated, with a predominantly white, a majority white population, that are now very racially segregated in the exact opposite direction, a predominantly African-American population. There are areas where the residential development, the residential fabric, especially toward the north end of the quarter, has significantly been thinned out. But there are also parts, again, more toward Midtown, toward Linwood, where you're seeing new development and new housing going up as well. So I really think Paseo, probably more than almost than any other boulevard or parkway in the city, reflects every level of demographic and social change that you've probably seen over the last 50 to 75 years.
I would share that comment. The other thing probably worth noting, The midway point on the Paseo is Brush Creek. And if we go back to the 70s, the location of Paseo and Brush Creek was all covered over. When Brush Creek was first built, they encapsulated a lot of this in underground tunnels, so you didn't see the creek.
Really?
And you could actually go all the way from where we're sitting here today, right off of Troost, all the way over to Woodland, and you didn't see Brush Creek. It was all covered over.
And this was for how long?
It goes back to the, back in the 20s probably, when that goes back. And then what happened after the Plaza flood, which, of course, happened in 77, they opened all that up. So now you see all of Brush Creek from street level. You can see the creek from where we are now back to the east. And now there's a bridge on the Paseo over Brush Creek, and it's simply a bridge, and you can see the entire bridge. So all that got opened up. The other thing that was at this location back in the probably the 20s and 30s was an amusement park. It's similar to Fairland Park or similar, you know, it's kind of the worlds of fun of the day that was located right on Brush Creek at this location. So this is going back quite a few in time. And there again, there's photographs that show all this, but that's all, you know, part of the past of that. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, Brush Creek is a natural channel, but it had some major improvements done to it for flood management and beautification through the Corps of Engineers and working with the city after the 77 Plaza flood.
We've talked about, I mean, we've hit on a lot of them, but does anyone in this room have a favorite landmark on Paseo that we haven't talked about yet? I mean, we've talked about the ornate freestanding stoplight in the middle of a traffic circle. We've talked about a sunken garden. We've talked about this bridge now over Brush Creek. Is there some favorite, because there are lots of little moments along this street that really jump out if you're paying attention.
I think the one that stands out to me is where the Paseo and Meyer Boulevard come together. That's pretty unique. You know, Paseo's heading straight south. It makes a sharp turn to the left. And then as it goes up the hill, it intersects with Meyer Boulevard and creates a beautiful green open space. This actually goes by the name of Dunn Park today. And there's a natural waterway going through there. And all of a sudden, you're on Meyer, and then all of a sudden, you're back on Paseo.
Okay, we're off to a break, but in a minute we'll be taking your questions about the spots on Paseo that have piqued your curiosity and observations about what it's like to live, work, and travel this changing historic boulevard. Call us up, 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Mark McHenry, the director of Kansas City's Parks Department, and design guy Daniel Serta about Paseo Boulevard, arguably the oldest boulevard in the city and definitely the longest, right, guys?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Getting a thumbs up.
Exactly.
Mamie Hughes is joining us now from the Central Exchange. You can join us as well at 816-235-2888 or tweet your comments using the hashtag IfYouBuildItKC. Mamie, you have been a voice in Kansas City for a long time. What does Paseo mean to you?
To me, Paseo means many things. But now, as we're talking about Paseo in general, I am reminded of the Women's Foundation that was planned way to the north, there at 9th or 10th. Mark knows exactly, but Barbara Pendleton was anxious for people, women, at the Central Exchange to preserve the legacy of a group who had done many things to contribute to Kansas City.
Well, Mamie, the Central Exchange has been involved in getting a fountain at 9th and Paseo restored. We've heard a little bit about it, but tell us about that project. Why did that fountain seem worthy of your attention?
Well, there was no fountain devoted to women. Barbara Pendleton talked about City Beautiful, about the city of fountains, but she said, why not women at the Central Exchange, who talk about issues, other organizations, and so forth, think about promoting women and the legacy of women, a diverse group, a dozen of them, who could have that fountain at 9th and Paseo. There was a design, and Barbara talked to some of the Board of Commissioners, Parks and Recreation, and we all knew that there needed to be money. And Barbara told the members who had volunteered to work with her that we would contribute so that there would be money for that project. Barbara died, and that group just faded. Years later, Joanne Collins took it up again, but obviously there weren't enough women to really make it come to life. But there had been a design, and some of us, I had looked at the book that Jane Flynn wrote, Women of Independent Minds, Women in Kansas City, and we were able to pull some of those women and their histories, and all of that would be inscribed on the plaques that would be decorative at the fountain.
I want to jump in and ask, Mark McHenry, is this the fountain you were talking about that's the oldest fountain in the city?
Yes, it is. And there again, it was originally built in 1899. It was designed by John Van Brunt in collaboration with George Kessler. And as Mamie makes reference to, it was in a serious state of decline. So the women leadership in our community, Central Exchange, stepped forth and brought forth resources to bring it back to where it is today. So we changed it. We actually didn't have a name. It was in the archives as the Fountain at 9th and Paseo.
And just no name.
No name. And so now with the leadership, there again, as Mamie indicates, it got a name and it got a new life.
You know, Mamie, before you go, you were really, really involved in community relations when 71 Highway was built in Kansas City. And I'm curious about the relationship between Paseo and that highway. They kind of jog along side by side in an unusual way.
They jog along, and the impact that the roadway did to the Paseo was of great concern about the people in the Beacon Hills neighborhood. And when that first plan was made and finished,
the plan for the highway,
the plan for 71 Highway that was Midtown Roadway, had that disturbance to the Paseo, and that was the Beacon Hills neighborhood who took that case to the United States District Court. And after 12 years and a redesign, there was a different impact, but it still is considered today to have a negative impact on the Paseo.
Do you agree with that? Do you feel that way about the highway?
I did not want that highway disrupting a number of things, but in particular, right in that area. And there were people who wanted to have greater access, and so the people won. The Beacon Hills people did feel that some of it was to their advantage, but the highway had acquired a number of the houses, and that was just a disappointment to us.
Well, Mamie Hughes, thanks so much for sharing your knowledge with us today. I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Thank you, and thank you for asking me. Goodbye.
Bye. I want to ask our other guests about this relationship between 71 Highway and other highways and the Paseo.
Well, I think the most important thing, because the debate percolates and sort of resurfaces every now and then, there's actually planning and engineering work being done right now by the city in and around 71 Highway to deal with specifically with pedestrian safety issues, as well as bicycle accommodations near, primarily along Prospect near US 71. The thing a lot of people don't recognize, you hear a lot of complaints, for example, about the signalized intersections. All of that was a consequence of what Mrs. Hughes was just talking about. There was tremendous concern from the community about the adverse impact that roadway, which is essentially, it was really designed as an interstate, was going to have on those neighborhoods. I remember, one of my early introductions to the East Side, this is probably, 25, 30 years ago, was discovering in a very startling way that there were about four city blocks of nothing in a very long north-south corridor, on the east side. And it was a very startling thing to see before the roadway was actually constructed. And I think it was largely in that state for about 20 years.
But what about this Paseo interstate
relationship? Well, the relationship, there's a major crossing, Mark, is it about 23rd, 22nd,
yes,
23rd?
In the Beacon Hill area.
In the Beacon Hill area, where because of the alignment of US 71, it cuts at a very acute angle with the Paseo. And there's a large segment of the surrounding residential development, as Mrs. Hughes alluded to, where homes were cleared. And there's some disruption of the Paseo itself at that location. It's peculiar, but it's not entirely unique. I mean, Penn Valley Park, in some respects, was disrupted the same way originally by the introduction of Southwest Traffic Way back in the late 1930s, and then eventually by the construction of I-35. And there have been efforts, for example, in Penn Valley Park recently to sort of remediate some of the adverse impact of that. We now have a column of trees again in the median of Broadway Boulevard, where it extends through Penn Valley Park. There are changes happening along and near the Paseo as well.
Well, and to tag on to that, and this is kind of moving back over to the west side, West Terrace Park, as we talked about, mm-hmm. one of the parks in the original park and boulevard system.
And where is that exactly?
West Terrace Park runs roughly from the north end of downtown. If you can kind of visualize the northwest corner of downtown, there's a park up there called Mulkey Square. And then by the FBI building, if you can visualize that. And then it runs along the West Bluffs down there by, used to be the Hereford Building. Now it's an HNTB.
So right there on the river.
On the river, yeah. And it overlooks the KCK, basically. And then it runs all the way down further south to about 23rd Street is where it goes to. But it's called West Terrace Park, but it's in bits and pieces today. I mean, there's about four or five different parks. And it was basically kind of sliced up, I guess, because mm-hmm. of I-35.
And 670.
670. So 670 yeah. and 35 were all, you know, interstate highway projects that mm-hmm. created pieces and sections. In hindsight, maybe that wasn't the best thing to do. I mean, it's good to have traffic flow, but it really broke into the system.
Let's get back to Paseo. We've got some comments from our listeners on Twitter, and we're hearing from Brian Stadler, who says, I'd really like to see a paved bicycle route connecting Kessler Park to the trolley track trail via Paseo Boulevard. Any more on this road diet you were talking about? Will Brian see some of the things he's hoping for?
He will actually see that in the not-too-distant future. There is an engineering firm that was recently hired to do that study all the way from Independence to 79th Street. And once those plans are developed, there's a good likelihood that you'll – in essence, it'll be lines is what it'll be. But it's obviously going to have signage associated with that.
There's a historical antecedent to that, too, that I think is interesting. I was doing research on the parks and boulevards many years ago and came across a controversy that erupted back in the mid-1890s where residents of Hyde Park, which was then being annexed into Kansas City as part of Westport's annexation to the city, were very upset that there weren't provisions being made for bridle paths along Gillam Road, for example. And it was an interesting debate because from the Parks Department's perspective, these were already defined as roadways. And what people were arguing for was actually accommodations for horses off of the roadway. And there was a desire not to disrupt the scenic landscape by introducing further pathways along the edges, which I thought was interesting. But there were actually, you know, in the early period, you can find historical photographs where you not only see these sort of, you know, either horse-drawn carriages or early automobiles, and you can see bicyclists along the boulevards and parkways as well.
Is Paseo going to present any unique challenges as far as accommodating bicyclists and pedestrians more, or do you anticipate that this will be smooth sailing?
I think it'll actually happen. I mean, there's obviously going to be dialogue with the community. Some stakeholders groups will be part of that, and traffic studies associated with that as well. But it looks like it's a great opportunity to demonstrate the improvements of Paseo along with some bike pedestrian travel.
And before we go, Brian Stadler also says that as a child, he would look for the illuminated signs of the Capri and Royale, those motels we were talking about, as an indication that he was almost home. So nice memories.
Landmarks in their own way.
Yeah. Our time is up. Daniel Serta, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Daniel's with us from Insight Planning and He's Vice Commissioner of the Board of the KCATA. Mark McHenry is Director of Kansas City's Parks Department. Thank you. This has been interesting.
Thank you, Gina.
You can listen back to this discussion about Paseo Boulevard at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. And keep talking on Twitter. We're at KCURCST, and you can use the hashtag IfYouBuildItKC. Tomorrow, we'll revisit our portrait session with William Least Heat Moon. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman, over and out.